Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Rural Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. If you were a European Jew fortunate enough to escape Hitler's stranglehold on your homeland, what would convince you to return to the place where everyone in power wanted you dead? It's difficult to imagine the kind of courage such action would require, and harder still to underestimate the importance of the naturalized Americans who did just that. For his latest project, military historian Pat K. O'Donnell uncovered the remarkable stories of the Jewish Five, a group of men who sacrificed the security of asylum in the United States to return to the scene of 20th century's most devastating assaults on humanity in an effort to bring down the strike once and for all. The new book is called They Dared Return, The True Story of Jewish Eyes Behind the Lines in Nazi Germany, and we are happy to have Mr. O'Donnell here to talk about it. Pat, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me on the air.
This story is fascinating for a lot of reasons, but I think chief among them is the irony of it all. These are Jews who escaped the Nazis and then returned to what was essentially the most heavily fortified Nazi outpost in the final days of the war.
That's indeed the case, and what's amazing is they had every step of the way they had to fight their way back into Nazi Germany, even their own bureaucracy here at the OSS and the U.S. Army.
Tell us about Friedrich Mayer, a man that you believe is worthy of the Congressional Medal of Honor.
Friedrich Mayer is 89 years old. Young. He's the most remarkable man that I've ever met in my life. I've interviewed 3,000 World War veterans and written 5 books on World War II, and I think out of all the vets that I've ever interviewed, he's the most remarkable person. Not only is They Dared Return a story, an adventure story, but it's really a book about life lessons, and I think if there ever anybody that I really admire, he's one person, because he's this incredibly happy-go-lucky guy that chops wood every day, feeds the poor every week with Wheels on Meals, and just doesn't hold any notion of vengeance at all. In fact, as we talk about the story, he was captured and later beaten by the Gestapo and SS for days, but totally forgave his captors. And I think that's one of those things that just blows me away.
And even as a kid, Mayer's character and his worldview were very much shaped by war stories.
Yes, indeed. Mayer was born in Freiburg in 1920, and his father was a veteran of the Kaiser's army. During World War I, he fought near Metz, which was an absolute meat grinder for the German army and the French army. And his father would regale him with war stories. He was an officer in the German army, and that was sort of Fred's education on what war was like. And he always wanted to uphold his father's tradition of honor and bravery. And Fred's one of those few people that I've ever met, and I've also talked to his colleagues, and it also comes out in the documents, even from the Gestapo, which still exists to this day, that he's a man that's absolutely fearless. You know, somebody once told me that Fred had his fear nerves snipped. He just was an absolutely fearless man that, you know, ultimately shooed behind the lines and disguised himself as a German officer to gather intelligence.
So Mayer's father, I guess, held out hope that patriotic Jews would be treated reasonably well, and his mother said, absolutely not, we've got to get out of here.
They had to get out of there, and I mean, things were starting to flare up within his own, in his own hometown. I mean, he was confronted by the youth and called a dirty Jew, and Fred literally flattened. He was the guy that really ran away from things. He flattened the kid and punted him out and, continued on. And then eventually, things were starting to get so bad that Mrs. Mayer saw the writing on the wall and knew, even his father wanted to stay, knew that they had to leave. And they emigrated to the United States right before World War II.
So before we talk a little bit more about the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, we should discuss the state of American espionage in the Second World War, because spying was, at that point, still a relatively new endeavor for the United States.
It's a new endeavor, and then there was also this natural aversion to spycraft and, sort of the dirty dealing of spycraft. I mean, it's something that still exists to this day. I mean, we're still talking about, whether or not, the moral implications of spying and doing certain things. And during, right before World War II, there was no CIA. there was a loose conglomeration of agencies that collected intelligence. For instance, the State Department had people gathering intelligence. The U.S. Army had a handful of men that were out there gathering intelligence, as well as the Naval Intelligence Officers. There was no real way for this stuff that was coming from the field to get to the White House. There was no clearinghouse. And right before we entered war, Britain was really hounding us to change our ways. And it's quite interesting. One of the characters that came to the United States was none other than E. Fleming, who was a naval intelligence officer. And they came ostensibly for, you know, as a cover to do port security, but in reality they came to convince FDR that something had to be done. And what was done was something called the Coordinator of Information, was the precursor to the OSS, and they had a name change a year later and called the Office of Strategic Services, effectively the first national intelligence agency. But it was not only just intelligence, it was also special operations and everything from counterintelligence on. It was all under one roof. And a really remarkable agency that drew from all aspects of society, you know, everybody from Ivy League folks to paratroopers down at Fort Benning that were needed for the special operations groups, to debutantes, to even safecrackers if they needed them.
Yeah, I think it's really fascinating throughout the book here to see that, especially in this period in our history, the military and intelligence services were populated by people with incredibly diverse backgrounds.
One of the things that the OS recruited heavily on was college professors and anthropologists, people that knew the cultures of the places that we were supposed to go to. I mean, not folks out there that are involved in counterterrorism, such as Max Boot and David Kilcullen, have all advocated that there's a need for the OSS-like organization to come back. Folks that are from, you know, all walks of life to really, you know, come out in some sort of an agency that really looks, you know, the cultural differences and understands what, you know, the cultural aspects of the folks that were engaged in that.
So talk about how Mayer and his colleagues were recruited for this mission and then how they started training before they headed into danger.
What I find fascinating is all along the way, Mayer and his colleagues, part of the Jewish Five, encountered resistance. When Pearl Harbor occurred, Fred went down to a local recruiting office and was, you know, recently a naturalized citizen, or was shortly afterwards, but he was classified an enemy alien. And there was concern that he could not join the U.S. Army. And it took him several months to actually talk his way into the U.S. Army. And several of the other men in the Jewish Five, who are Americans or becoming Americans at this time, had similar problems. But they all had the yearning desire to do something about the war rather than, you know, stay behind. They wanted to take the fight to Hitler directly. So they joined the regular army, and in one way or another, the OSS found them. In Fred Mayer's case, really extraordinary. He was on field maneuvers in desert training in Yuma, Arizona, and his Wildcat division was being trained up to fight in North Africa. And part of the exercise is, Fred Mayer was like a scout in his small unit, his reconnaissance unit, and he literally captured the opposing general in this military exercise, and he captured the entire headquarters, and everybody was dumbfounded. A single guy changed the entire course of the maneuver, and they actually thought he cheated, and they said, you know, you're not supposed to do this, and Fred said to them, you know, the rules of war, there are no rules in war. You have to win. And that point on, he was destined to get out of the infantry, and he was subsequently recruited to the Office of Strategic Services, which had a training ground in Washington, D.C. at the Congressional Country Club. Congressional Country Club, which is a golf course, was changed into a commando training center, and something called the German Operational Group was born, which was about 30 men from various walks of life, including people that escaped concentration camps and even a former Luftwaffe pilot, and mixed into that was the Jewish Five, these five men who at this training ground became best friends. And, you know, they said to one of them said to me, Bernie Steinitz, he's like, I've never been with such an eclectic group of desperados in my life. Everybody was nuts, but I fit right in. And it was kind of like this Dirty Dozen type scenario where all these guys are learning how to blow things up and silent kill and commando tactics, essentially.
Patrick K. O'Donnell is my guest. His new book called They Dared Return, The True Story of Jewish Spies Behind the Lines in Nazi Germany. Yeah, so at this place, they're learning map reading and hand-to-hand combat and how to improvise weapons and demolitions and tank driving, and they learn how to parachute.
All these things that they think are needed behind the lines, effectively, they create the first Green Beret team, or one of the first. And it's called the German Operational Group, and it's headed up by this guy named Howard Chappell, an extraordinary individual in his own right. And they are shipped overseas to become part of they're supposed to land behind lines in the Black Forest and destroy a ball bearing plant. That's sort of what the rumors are, that the unit's going to be doing that. But they touch down. They go by ship across the Atlantic, and they go to the wrong port. Absolutely bizarre, but they go into the wrong port by accident. And since they're a secret organization, the OSS, nobody knows who they are. And there's doubts of who these people are. They know that they're parachute qualified. And the commanding general's Repo Depot is what it's known as, decides that they want to take Mayer and all the other men and turn them into just parachute units. They want to, you know, effectively, they want to send them to the 80s Airborne and the 101st.
Just to be warm bodies, basically.
Yeah, and these guys know that their job is much more. They've spent a year training for this mission, and they, once again, they're fighting against system, and they effectively mutiny from the unit, and they take off in a Jeep, and they find OSS headquarters on their own, and convince the commanding officer that, look, we are qualified. We've spent a year training to go back, and we can do it. And they were dumbfounded that they found these folks that they were really willing to risk their lives, because the 12 prior missions that went behind the lines into Austria had all been killed or captured. That's how perilous this stuff was. And not only that, they were Jewish Americans, and they would probably die if they were caught. And, the one thing that really was so striking is during the interview process, this group, you know, Mayer was confronted. Are you really serious about going back behind the lines? Or, you know, parachuting behind the lines? Mayer just shot back, look, this is more our war than it's your war. Hmm. And that's how determined they were to go back.
Yeah, because all these guys had personally experienced devastating losses because of the war.
And what's even more tragic is, They don't know it at the time, but many of their families, some do, some of them know that their families are in camps, and some don't. But what's most tragic at the end of the war, when they find out many of their relatives are dead from the Nazis.
Military historian Patrick K. O'Donnell is my guest. His newest book is called Dared Return, The True Story of Jewish Spies Behind the Lines in Nazi Germany. Join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in just a couple minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. Make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. Learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is military historian Patrick K. O'Donnell. His newest book is called They Dared Return, The True Story of Jewish Spies Behind the Lines in Nazi Germany. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call at 1-800-933-5372. So, Patrick, what was their plan for when they got to this place, Innsbruck, in Austria?
Well, each of the five was then broken down. It's quite interesting. And given three of the, they were given, the five was divided into three missions: Operation Greenup, Operation Danny and Operation Dylan. And then they were paired, it's really quite remarkable, they were paired with German deserter volunteers or former prisoners of war, Germans that had actually fought, in some cases, on the Russian front, but had leanings toward the Allied cause. In most cases, these men were patriots that wanted to bring down the Reich, too, because they felt evil. Some cases, they were also motivated by money. But these deserter volunteers then coupled with German, these Jewish Americans, formed into these teams that were then sent back behind into the Reich. Each team was then organized their own mission as to where they were going to op.
So
the
book, go ahead.
The book focuses on primarily Operation Greenup, which is Fred Meyer's mission and Hans Winberg's mission, drop into an area called the Alpine Redoubt, which was the most heavily defended area of the Third Reich at the time. And it was an alpine area where there were plans, Nazis had plans to actually fortify it with fortifications and even bury underground factories to fight on the war, basically.
And before Winberg and Meyer were assigned to go and start identifying these turncoats, essentially, that might in fact help the Allied cause, they were given, even there behind enemy lines, sort of some final tests to make sure they were ready.
That was one of the most incredible things. Fred Meyer was actually part of the test, actually to get him up to speed with his German and, you know, general phrases and things like that. He dressed as a German officer and was escorted by several MPs that were working for the OSS and dropped into a prisoner of camp outside of Naples, Italy. And inside the camp were, you know, thousands of SS and Africa Corps officers, you know, the hardened core of the German army that had been fighting the Allies. And inside the camp, Meyer had to live and survive. And inside, as well as not only live and survive, but he also met his teammate, Franz Werber, who was a German officer. And the two became friends. And Meyer decided to trust this man. And Weber was brought on to the team. And they dropped outside of Innsbruck, where he had resided before the war.
And Weber's an interesting figure because, first of all, he was raised near Innsbruck, and he was a patriotic Austrian, but no Nazi.
Indeed. But what's fascinating is, at the beginning of the war, Weber was in some of the most hardened units of the Wehrmacht. He was even part of a commando team that would win. They were basically in a commando team that would seize bridges. It was considered a suicide mission. They'd seize the bridge, and most of the time they died. Fortunately, he made it, and then he was assigned as a lieutenant and fought throughout the Russian front and as well as Yugoslavia. But he saw as the war progressed that, you know, the Nazis were an evil, and he wanted to leave his homeland. So he effectively surrendered to the Allies and was in this POW camp and then wanted a way to somehow free his homeland.
And one of the ways that they would, one of the tactics that they would use to sort of identify people and make sure that they could be trusted, was they would play this sort of good cop, bad cop game.
Indeed. There was another group of men. The German Austria section, which Meyer and the other five entered into, were staffed largely by other refugees that were also Jewish, remarkably. Dino Lowenstein and Walter Haas were part of the staff on the German Austria desk, and they would go into these POW camps and try to recruit people, and they would play mind games with them and try to find out, you know, are there any spies in here? And they would try to get people to talk, and then they would pull this, like, kind of good cop, bad cop routine, and they would test out, you know, who was potential candidate material and who wasn't. And a lot of this, that's really interesting, was against the Geneva Convention. But the OSS was so desperate for trained agents or people that would pass that they were going into these POW camps to find agent material. And what's remarkable is this is an untold story of World War II. All these deserter volunteers that risked their lives to go back and somehow bring down the Reich, when they knew full well if they were caught, they would be executed for betraying Nazi Germany.
And we should remind people, this is all happening in 1944, not long after the failed attempt to assassinate Hitler, which meant that the Gestapo and the SS had been given more authority than ever to try, in fact, and ferret out enemies of the state.
Oh, it was even worse than that. I mean, this is one of the most intense police states in history. They would literally, the Gestapo would parachute fake Allied agents into areas of Austrian Germany, and they would go up to local villagers and ask for help and anything else, and those that provided help and shelter were then paid a visit by the Gestapo and typically executed on the spot, or their families were sent to the concentration camps. So these men were parachuting into hostile territory, completely hostile territory. It wasn't like France, where the civilian population had Allied sympathies and leanings and would provide shelter to the Allied agents. This is an area that was completely barren of that for the most part.
So it wasn't even easy to find a place, literally, to sort of sleep and get food.
And the only reason why that they did was the fact that Franz Weber accompanied the team, and his contacts and his family members, he convinced them to risk their lives to help the green-up team.
What do you think made Weber trust them?
There's so much serendipity in the book, and you really don't know. It seems like or fate almost. The fact that Mayer and Weber meet at the POW camp in Naples is just a remarkable coincidence. And I think the men Fred Mayer has this personality of you can trust him. And you really just believe in him. And that sense, this is a man that had his fear nerves literally stepped. I mean, he just is able to do some amazing things. And I think it was through that, his spirit of personality, that Weber trusted him.
How did Mayer fall into Gestapo hands?
This is it's really quite remarkable. Mayer, against the wishes of the OSS, donned one of Franz Weber's uniforms and disguised himself as a first lieutenant in an Alpine Ranger unit. And for the next several weeks, went through Innsbruck, Austria. First he was at an officer's convalescence home, literally the belly of the beast. He disguises himself as a German officer, and then he goes down to the local bar. You know, I mean, saw that movie, Inglourious Basterds. There's a scene in there that just sort of reminds me of this. He gets down to the bar, and he starts lifting beer steins with these officers that are recovering from their wounds. I mean, just absolutely complete chutzpah. He was drinking with them, and one of them even turns to him and says, "You're probably an enemy agent." Mayer just laughs it off and starts to sort of just blend in. He felt right at home. And these men started to talk. They talked about their experiences. One of them was an engineer who worked on the Hitler's bunker in Berlin, and Mayer transmitted that valuable intelligence on the exact location of Hitler's bunker, the dimensions and everything else from this engineer back to his headquarters. And it's like, you know, this is an actual radio transmission that now is a piece of yellowed paper at the National Archives in College Park. I mean, it's all true stuff. And he was doing all these things. And what happens is, even go down to the rail yard in Innsbruck, Austria, and talks to the loadmaster and finds out that there are 26 trains that are going to go through the Brenner Pass, calls in an airstrike and destroys all of them. But Fred Mayer's luck eventually runs out when one of his sub-agents turns him in. And it's a midnight knock on the door, and, in the dead of the night, he knows it's trouble. He pitches an intelligence document that he had into a pot belly of an open fire and threw his pistol under the pillow of a couch, and he was immediately arrested by the Gestapo. Threw him to the floor and asked who he was, and he just claimed that he was a French electrician because he had another identity that he used. And they whisked him up to Gestapo headquarters. And, I mean, one of the things that we talk about today is waterboarding. Fred Mayer was waterboarded for 3 days straight. He was hung upside down. He was beaten with a cowhide whip and just extensively tortured and roughed up. But he never broke. He never let the Gestapo know that he was Jewish, and he didn't reveal that he was an agent. And what's even, you know, under all these circumstances, he wouldn't crack.
Well, it's remarkable that they didn't kill him instantly. He was helped in large part by this radio operator named Hermann Matul. Can you tell us about him?
One of the stories that runs in parallel with the other mission is something called Operation Deadwood. And Hermann Matul is a deserter volunteer that volunteered to go back behind the lines as a spy for the OSS. And he's really a very remarkable figure. He is a German soldier that fights, around in France and later in Africa, and is wounded. But he's always sort of in it for himself, and he uses his wound to his advantage, and somehow is able to go back to Hamburg, Austria, under the auspices of his wound, and he sets up black market operations under the eyes of the Gestapo, which is really incredible that he's able to pull this off. He's later rounded up again and then put back into the German army, but eventually crosses over to the Allied sides, fights with the partisans a little bit, and then becomes a prisoner of war. And Lowenstein and Haas find him in a prisoner of war camp, and he is recruited to become an agent. And he, but they really know his real loyalties, because Mattel is also in it for the money, and he's sort of a con man and a hustler. And Lowenstein says, if he's going to hustle, he's going to hustle for the OSS. So they recruit this guy in on Operation Deadwood, but they're really not sure of his loyalties. He drops in behind the lines and, effectively blends in a bit, and then does something really stupid. He smokes an American cigarette in front of several German soldiers, who then are very suspicious. They case him for about a day, and they follow him around. He even hides in an SS barracks, because he needs a place to stay. But is rounded up, and he's brought in front of probably one of the Reich's great counterinsurgency terrorist experts, this guy named Otto Schiffer, who's a Gestapo major, who tortures him also, and then tells one of the great lies of the war, that he was there to recruit like Schiffer to fight the Russians. And another opportunity comes when Mayer is captured. They ask Matul, they put a picture in front of him and say, "Do you know this guy Mayer?" And Matul says to the SS Gestapo, "Yes, I do. And he's a very high-ranking OSS officer, and you don't kill him. He's extremely valuable to you, and really the governor of the area should talk to him." And that's exactly what happens. This fake lie that Matul concocts under tort is bought wholesale by the SS and Gestapo, as well as the highest-ranking Nazi official in the area, Franz Hofer, who then decides to see Fred Mayer for himself.
And it only takes a few days for things to turn around remarkably.
Indeed. Mayer, who is beaten for 3 days in this cell, and he thinks he's going to be executed at any moment. And Reichenau concentration camp is right nearby, and he's actually interned there for a brief period, is confronted by Franz Hofer's assistant, who is a medical doctor by trade, a plastic surgeon. And Mayer finds himself, instead of in a cell, at a dinner table with Franz Hofer. And it's absolutely an amazing turnabout. And Mayer is effectively, the war is winding down, and effectively plays to Hofer's fears that, if you don't do the right thing, you're going to be prosecuted as a war criminal and hung. But if you work with me, I might be able to save you from a little bit of that.
And talk about the remarkable calm that was required to do. Mayer was walking into this dinner party that you mentioned, thinking that it was very likely that he was poisoned by the food that he sat down to eat.
Yeah, he was. A bowl of hot boiling soup was placed in front of him, and Mayer had all of his teeth cracked because an SS guard had shoved a rifle barrel and a Luger pistol into his teeth and cracked most of his front teeth. So he was in incredibly agonizing pain. And he's sitting there with all these knots. They're starting to joke about the war and things like that. And Mayer just looks down at the soup and decides not to eat it. And Hofer just looks at him and says, "It's okay. We haven't done anything to it." And somehow he just does spoon in there and drinks a little bit of the soup, which is the first meal that he's had literally in 3 days. And Mayer then works on Hofer's mind. It's an incredible story. I mean, Hofer is one of the most hardened Nazis. He had been with Hitler since the beginning, and it was even his idea to create this so-called Alpine Redoubt, where the Nazis would make their last stand, and Hofer was going to go down a blaze of glory. But Mayer worked on his mind and said, "Look, it's crazy. work with me, and I will, you know, I will protect you from war crimes prosecution, even though Mayer had no authority to do anything like that. And ultimately, after several days, Mayer convinced Hofer to make a radio broadcast over the air and ordered all of the German army in the area, thousands, tens of thousands of troops, to lay down their arms and declare Innsbruck an open city.
Pat K. O'Donnell is my guest. He's a military historian whose latest book is called They Dared Return, The True Story of Jewish Spies Behind the Lines in Nazi Germany. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Rural Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is military historian Patrick K. O'Donnell. We're talking about his book, They Dared Return, The True Story of Jewish Spies Behind the Lines in Nazi Germany. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-532 or send email to think@kera.org. You alluded to this earlier, and I want to go back to it. You talked about the fact that Mayer was able to forgive those who were cruelest to him, including this his rank escapes me now, Walter Guttner, who had actually been behind the torture of Mayer when he was held by the Gestapo.
Walter Guttner was a criminal rat or a detective in Austria. He was a police officer, and his job was basically to hunt down Allied agents as well as take care of, you know, criminal activities in Innsbruck. He was not exactly the most competent guy, but he was good enough to round up Mayer. And then he supervised and he participated in the actual torture of Fred Mayer, who had been brought into Gestapo headquarters, and as I mentioned earlier, was beaten, hung upside down, put on a Mauser rifle in a ball-like state, and then with a cowhide whip, and then later waterboarded. And Guttner supervised this and then also started to interview Mayer and try to find out where Hans Winberg was, the radio operator, and try to extract other details. But Mayer it didn't crack. I mean, this is a case where torture didn't work, clearly. And Guttner was responsible for this. And then after the war, the day after the war ended, Guttner was on foot and he was fleeing for his life because he knew that he was considered a war criminal. And then he made the mistake of taking a battered picture of Fred Mayer with him, and he kept it in his coat pocket. It's really not really clear why Guttner did this. I mean, it's sort of sadistic, or, you know, it's not known. But he was on foot, and he was fleeing, and what happened is American counterintelligence agents, which had now entered Innsbruck, it was a free city thanks to Mayer and his efforts, and found her, and they brought him into the same cell that Mayer had been beaten in, and they roughed him up to try to get information from him, and they found Fred Mayer and said, "Would you like to speak with Guttner?" And it was sort of a code for, "You want to beat up Guttner?" And Mayer told me he couldn't wait to get in to see Guttner. I mean, he was just absolutely, it was sort of a, in a sense, he went there for revenge, and, you know, here's Guttner, handed him on a pedestal, a chance to really get back at the man that beat him up. And Guttner was in the cell, and Mayer walked in there, and he saw Guttner, like, cowering in the corner, and he saw that he had been beaten up, too. And that really kind of disgusted him. Guttner locked eyes with Mayer and said, "You can do anything you want to me, but just don't harm my family." And you know, this sort of wave of sympathy kind of went over Fred Mayer, who just looked at the man who was cowering in the corner, and he just looked at him and said to him very sternly, you think we are, Nazis? And he turned his back on Gettner. And, you know, it's an incredible thing. It's an act of forgiveness. I mean, in a sense, in a place where he had the right for vengeance, really, in many ways, but he sort of forgave Gettner. And I think that's one of the great lessons of the book, about forgiveness and let things go.
So these remarkable bonds were formed among the team who made all of this possible, to the extent that Franz Wehr, the Austrian who sort of helped the team, had a fiance, and because of the privations of the war, they were didn't know how they were going to make her a wedding gown. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I found this really remarkable. After the war, the five were reunited. I mean, there were two missions, and these men somehow made it back alive, barely. One of the missions was misdropped in Yugoslavia, and they had to literally go on foot for 2 months back to Italy. And the other man, Bernie Steinitz, barely escaped CAD. But they were reunited, and Franz Weber wanted to marry his fiancée, his great love. I mean, the book has got a love story in it, too. It's Franz's fiancée is a cohort or a spy with the team. She provides, you know, she is a courier. And Mayer even falls in love, too, behind the lines. But Weber's story is probably the most compelling, and he wants to marry his fiancée. There is no silk at all in war-torn Austria, except for one thing that they forgot, which was the parachute supply, the parachutes that they used to supply the team, which had been buried on the side of a glacier under deep snow. And Franz and his fiancée, along with some of the other team members, went back to the glacier and uncovered the parachute, the green and white parachute silk, and they fashioned a wedding dress for Franz's fiancée out of the parachute silk.
And then after the war, all of these guys went home, and this was still sort of background, and the stories were not made public. They just returned to their lives.
Yeah, I mean, once said to me, you know, if this happened today, this would be a reality show. But these guys are different. They're a different breed. This goes for the entire, I think, World War II generation. These people this group of veterans, men and women, just sort of faded back into society and didn't want any kind of glory or anything like that. And these men didn't really receive any medals or anything or any recognition. And they just back into civilian life. Fred, for instance, was worked at a power plant, Voice of America. He ran the power plant around the world, and Bernie Steinitz became an accountant. George Gerbner was a professor at UPenn. They just sort of, and Hans Winberg is a chemistry professor in Holland. I mean, these guys just sort of went back into, and then they did some extraordinary things in their civilian jobs. But they shied away from recognition, and they're still... That's one of the things I love about these men. They're self-effacing. It's not about them. It was always about the mission and trying to do something better for the war and for other people.
So how did you first get wind of this story and think to yourself, I've got to know everything there is to know?
I wrote a book called Operative Spies and Saboteurs. It's an oral history of the OSS. And when I was doing the research for the book, I stumbled across Fred Mayer. And, you know, it was at that point, I really liked this guy. I mean, he became a friend of mine. The first couple sentences, I just wanted to know more. And then I started to do the research for this book, and I was literally 10,000 documents going through, sifting through just boxes and boxes of documents at the National Archives. I was like an archaeologist trying to uncover this story, trying to find out more, and trying to put pieces of a jigsaw puzzle that were scattered all over the place together. And it was just, you know, through that was sort of the opening. And then I just knew that this is a book I always wanted to write.
And so several of these guys are still alive. We should say they were very young when they were doing all this, most in their early 20s.
That's right. Three of the five are still alive. Freyer, Hans Winberg, and Bernie Steinitz, who lives in L.A., they're still alive.
Were they happy to hear from you, or did they think this is all in the past and I don't want to talk about this?
They were happy to hear from me about the book. They were all just like, they were all very thankful, but it's all a very self-effacing manner. It was, even to this day, it was not about them. it was sort of about the mission, and I think they were happy that they're happy that the mission has been told. But it wasn't. It really very, very selfless to this day. I mean, Fred Mayer, for instance, every week does meals and helps feed the poor, chops wood. I mean, I think the book is not only an adventure story, but it's really a book about life and, you know, some really remarkable individuals.
Is he a storyteller himself?
No, not at all. In fact, you know, he's not a person that likes to talk about himself, and he won't sit there and talk about the mission. He won't ramble on. He's always like, please ask me the questions. I had to lead him through the whole thing. I had to have the mission reports with me. He wasn't trying to glorify himself in any way.
You're fortunate in many ways that their memories are so strong of these events.
They are, and I was also surprised that the memories actually, problems with oral history sometimes is it doesn't sync up with the documents. But in this case, I was really surprised. The documents and the oral histories matched up, and nobody, like, tried to exaggerate their story. And it's really remarkable is they dared return. I think in some cases, the facts are is better than fiction.
We have an email here from Bhaskar who says, thank you for bringing this story to us. Mayer's story would make an incredible movie. Are there plans to turn this into a movie?
We certainly have some feelers that are out, and then also interest coming back from Hollywood. I mean, Inglourious Basterds sort of shed light on something, you know, and it's like now I think people are interested in some of the real life story, and I hope it just gets told so that people like Mayer, I think Fred Mayer deserves a Medal of Honor, and I've interviewed 3,000 veterans from every campaign in World War II, and I think I can say with some degree of credibility. I just hope that, you know, that a movie is made would shed some light on the heroic efforts of these people that they did during the...
What do you think it is, Patrick, that makes that generation, in fact, the greatest generation? What makes them different from our own?
I mean, I'm going to say this. I've been with our troops overseas. I fought in the Battle of Fallujah. I think that this is the next greatest generation they have now. I think that this band of warriors, nobody knows anything of them. I'm really impressed with them, as was this world. I mean, the World War II generation is, I think Brokaw's term is correct, the greatest generation. And I think that the two generations together are really remarkable. And I think that it's the story of, like, I mean, when I was in a Marine platoon in Fallujah, I saw people that had been shot multiple times but had refused evacuation because they wanted to stay with their brothers. There's a lot of remarkable stories out there to this day that are not being told also. But sadly, generation of World War II veterans, every day, you know, we have 2,000 of them slipping away. And of the 3,000 that I've interviewed, I'd say there's probably 500 left.
Yeah, and you've written that you feel like this is your personal mission, and there's really no time to lose in documenting the story we can still glean.
I've been sort of up against the clock. Not a job for me. It's sort of my passion. I just really enjoy somehow trying to preserve some of these stories before they slip away. And I've literally, many of the men that I've interviewed were on their deathbed, and they did not tell anybody their stories. And I was the first person they talked to. And it's like, if I had one, you know, mission in these books, it's like, get out there and talk to your relatives. I mean, we have so many fake heroes out there in this day and age. It's like the real heroes are your uncles, your grandfathers, grandmothers that, you know, fought in this war, and each of them has an amazing story to tell. Go, you know, have them tell to you before they pass.
Beyond the ability of us who have lived safely in this country all this time just to say thank you to these people, what do you think get as Americans in seeking to understand the experiences of the people who fought to keep safe?
I think that the book is, you know, like I said before, an incredible book about life lessons. It's about just ordinary people, you know, Fred Mayer, who's this ordinary kid, that do really extraordinary and heroic things. And then, in some ways, it just, I really found them to be incredible Americans. Just their way that he lives life every day to the full, you know, chops wood and, you know, has a smile on his face, is really an optimist. I mean, those are the things that I got from the book. And it was also about forgiveness. I was blown away by that. You know, I mean, here's a guy that had every reason to strike back at Gettner and the Gestapo, but he walked away and he did the right thing and he sleeps well every night.
Did Fred like the book?
He does. That, for me, you know, I got a call from him and he said that he really into the book and he's like, thank you for telling my story. And for me, that was the greatest compliment. That was who I was, you know, these are the men in the book are my judges for the most part. I wanted to get the story right. And I'm just honored that I had an opportunity to tell it.
Patrick K. O'Donnell is a military historian and the author of 6 books. The latest is called They Dared Return, the true story of Jewish spies behind the lines in Nazi Germany. Patrick, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thanks for having me on the air.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is a production of KERA and is made possible by KERA listeners and supporters. The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilufar Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.